I have the opportunity, hopefully, not to put you to sleep after lunch with shoulder overuse injuries. So kind of an overview of what we're going to go over is kind of shoulder impingement syndrome, some bicep tendinitis, or tendinitis, and distoclavicular osteolysis, GERD or glenohumeral internal rotation deficit, and little leaguer shoulder. So just kind of jumping in, when I lecture to residents and fellows and things like that, we really stress, really the whole thing, especially for the shoulder, really comes down to physical exam and history. I really think about 90% of our diagnosis comes from the history. And everything you do after that is kind of confirming or denying what you're thinking that's going with. So we just really reinforce our diagnosis. Most of them are fairly predictable. And at the very end, I have a table that I stole from one of my partners, Steve Flores, that really helps you narrow down when you're looking at diagnosis. And then one thing you have to look at is some of these pathological conditions, sometimes they overlap. Sometimes you have rotator cuff tendonitis with bicep tendonitis, and you really have to figure out which one's the causing factor and treat that to help with the underlying condition. So first thing we're gonna start with is shoulder impingement syndrome. And really this is just a generic kind of term that, in my view, it's something I use for diagnosis that I have to put in to bill for a visit. But it really all encompasses, you know, multiple things. So it can include bursitis or tendonitis of the rotator cuff. Some people like to include kind of hooked acromions and things like that, all in this impingement syndrome. But it's kind of all lumped into this this syndrome. And when you have a syndrome, it's really just all encompassing that we really don't know the exact pathology. And I think I'm going to kind of dive in deeper to that. But if you really look at the literature, it says about 40 to 60% of all shoulder pain, kind of, if you look at diagnosis codes, all undergo this idea of shoulder impingement. So pathophysiology, I mean, there's about three different ways that we think you can get impingement, and it's really likely a combination of everything, all three of these together. So you have extrinsic compression, that's more of your anatomy. Is the humeral head and the rotator cuff impinging on the acromion? Or do you have a tight or calcified CA ligament that can cause impingement as well as some areas of the AC joint as well. Then you have the intrinsic or degenerative things where if you have a tear, degenerative or partial tear or inflammation of the rotator cuff, you're really looking at, if that's inflamed or you have a partial tear, you have a high riding humeral head, which can actually give you some impingement against the acromion as well. And then kind of more what you see in the more athletic population is probably more of this inflammatory process, really an inflammation of the subacromial bursa where it's really impinging as you elevate the arm. So presentation, probably, you know, nothing really groundbreaking on this, but really it's the really gradual onset. Really, there's no big injury that occurs. Most of the athletes or patients that come in to say this kind of gradually came on. And when I start doing overhead activities or lifting away from my body is when I have the biggest set of pain. The biggest thing that really brings people in is really the nighttime pain. I think that's really the factor when they come in and say, I can't sleep, is the thing that kind of has them present saying that they're having difficulty and they're looking for a treatment option at that point. Most of the time, physical exam, the strength is normal on the rotator cuff. You know, most of the time when these people come in, a lot of times the initial visit, and most athletes, if the shoulder's that inflamed, you can't even get a great exam on them. And it's kind of one of those where maybe it could be a rotator cuff, but the shoulder's so inflamed, I can't even get their arm above 90 degrees. I can't really tell what they're having. But most of these all have, you know, the positive Hawkins and near signs just showing impingement. Positive Job test and usually a painful arc, normally about 60 to 120 degrees, but sometimes it can be more or less. A lot of times, my experience, patients can't even get above 90 degrees if they're really coming in and inflamed. Imaging, you know, anytime you walk in the doctor's office, in an orthopedic office, you're getting x-rays. I don't know if you really need that for these impingement type syndromes. Most of the time in the training rooms, things like that, won't really defer to an x-ray because I don't know how much information to give. More in the, as you get into the 40, 50 year olds, that's the time you start looking at the x-rays. Do you have proximal migration of the humeral head? Are you looking at an arthritic situation? Are you getting osteophytes? Do you have that calcified CA ligament like we talked about earlier? You know, talk about a type 3 hooked acromion. I'm not a big fan of these hooked acromions and really displaying the type 1, 2, 3 really causing the big pain. I'm just not a big person thinking that the acromion anatomy by itself is causing this huge amount of pathology with the patient. I'm one that does not do an acromioplasty except in a very rare circumstance. And then you always think of, you know, the zebra in there, the osteochromiale, which is a lack of formation of the one part of the acromion as well. MRI is really initially when patients come in, every patient wants an MRI as soon as they walk in my door, and I spend more time honestly talking them out of an MRI than actually talking them into getting one. But you know, if you're suspecting a rotator cuff tear, I think it has some room. But otherwise, all you're really going to see is some inflammation in the subacromial subdeltoid area. Treatment, physical therapy, anti-inflammatory and subacromial injections. I think this is really the mainstay of all these overuse injuries. Not even on this slide, you'll notice, do I talk about surgery? Because I really don't think a surgical option in this type of thing is really that much of a benefit unless this patient's really failed this non-operative line, meaning months and months of non-operative management. My initial thing, and when a patient comes in with a hugely inflamed shoulder, they don't want to move it, is really to go to the subacromial injection first, because in my mind, it's therapeutic and diagnostic. I'm putting it in the shoulder. One, it's going in that subacromial space. So one, therapeutic, if the patient gets relief, they like you a whole lot better. And two, we know we're working on the right area. Because if they get no relief, if I see them back in 2 weeks and they're like, that injection did not work at all, I start looking elsewhere. I start looking at the neck or something else that may be causing this. Because you really don't want to start a shotgun approach and start saying, let's get MRIs, let's do all this stuff. My idea is we want to narrow it down first and start treating that instead of a shotgun approach. There was some, probably about 2 years ago, PRP made its big push in the shoulder. If you look at recent literature, really no use for subacromial bursitis. There's some spotty literature saying maybe partial rotator cuff tear is it's a option, but really I don't see, I have done 0 in 5 years PRP injections for subacromial impingement. Next thing we're gonna move on to is bicep tendonitis. And so if you look back at the literature and really the description of bicep tendonitis, they really believed it initially was something in an older population of the rotator cuff. Initially, we thought this was a static stabilizer in the shoulder. It really didn't have any movement with the shoulder. But if you look more, the bicep tendon actually has a huge responsibility in movement, especially for overhead athletes. As you get in the abducted external rotation range, it really does act as a keeping too much proximal migration of the humeral head and forcing it backwards. And I think this is where we start getting into more of the impingement or inflammation of that in these overhead athletes. So looking at, you know, there's different types. You get the elderly population that has these degenerative tears of this, but I think the true tendonitis are more in the athletic populations, 18 to 35 year olds, where this is more of an overuse type thing. And a lot of times the bicep tendonitis is not isolated. It's normally with some kind of scapular instability, some kind of shoulder instability, or a lot of times more in the posterior capsular tightness or the people with GERD is the time you're gonna see it more. This is pretty predictable when the patients come in. They have this dull anterior pain. There's not a lot of things. The shoulder can be very unpredictable as far as localizing things. The bicep tendon is pretty easy to diagnose that because the patients come in and say it hurts right in that's in the bicipital groove. It's really the only, a lot of the patients come in saying, my shoulder's popping out of place all the time. Well, I doubt their shoulder's popping out of place all the time. It's really what you're feeling is that bicep tendon popping in and out of the groove, because a lot of times you either have inflammation or damage to the transverse humeral ligament that's caused it to move with external rotation or extreme forward flexion or abduction. You know, it can be, like we talked about, these can overlap. It can be seen with rotator cuff and subacromial pathology. It's kind of one of those things where, like I talked about, I like the subacromial injection because if we get no relief with that, a lot of times that subacromial injection is not going to hit the bicep tendon at all, given its location. The subacromial injection will clamp down the rotator cuff as well as the subacromial space, but a lot of times leave you isolated to that bicep tendon and kind of push you in that direction. Physical exam, again, tenderness with the arm slightly internally rotated 10 degrees, you can feel on that area. I have clinic this morning, I saw two of these of my 30 patients were isolated bicep tendonitises that I hadn't, you know, that were just pinpoint right in that area. The speed test is good for that, but it can also overlap with slap tears. And I think that's one thing you have to keep in mind, especially with these overhead athletes, probably the high school, college age, is keeping in mind a slap lesion when you get this positive speeds, because you can go through a whole workup on bicep tendonitis. And I've actually done this about 2 years ago. I had a swimmer that had bad bicep tendonitis by MRI and everything, bad bicep tendonitis, got better initially with an injection and then kept having problems. repeated the MRI, still looked like bicep tendonitis. Finally took her and scoped, and what she had was a full slap tear that was actually had peeled off the face of the glenoid, which we didn't even pick up on two MRIs with contrast. Jurgensen's another one that you'd kind of express, you know, putting pressure on that bicep tendon, why it's in a bicepital groove. And then the Popeye deformity, which should actually be a reverse Popeye deformity, is where you get the sag opposite of it with a proximal rupture. These, I actually saw one of these today too. It was just like bicep pathology in clinic. But these you normally associate with swelling and a lot of ecchymosis in that area if you do get an acute rupture of that. More of the attritional ruptures you normally don't, but with the acute ruptures you will. Imaging, radiographs negative, ultrasound. I think this has been a bigger push and something that I'm adopting into my practice now is using an ultrasound because it's an easy modality that you can use in the clinic instead of sending a patient for an MRI because MRIs, even though everyone wants it, once they start getting what the bill is, they don't want the MRI as much. But this is an easy way that you can easily look at the bicipital groove. If you look at the, you can see this inflammation kind of on this T2 axial image, you can kind of see the bicep sitting in the groove right here, but it's a little inflammation right down at the bottom. And this is a contrast MRI. Then you kind of look at the coronal views as well. You can see the bicep coming up, push on, but you see that white right in here. The extra articular part is nice and dark, but as you come up, you see the white coming across. And this could be almost a point where this is a partial tear of the bicep tendon. So again, treatment, again, we're going with the non-operative management. I mean, really, bicep tendonitis, especially in an overhead athlete, requires any surgical intervention. First line, rest, we gotta stop the inciting factor. We gotta shut down from throwing, we gotta shut down from the overhead activities to let it rest. Anti-inflammatories, I think the, again, we talked about the ultrasound. We can use ultrasound, especially in these superficial things for injections in this area. So we can see the bicep tendon, and this is not mine, this is from one of our muscle skeletal radiologists, but this is the bicep tendon running through. You can see the change and the contrast of the white coming across tells us there's inflammation. The other thing you start seeing is how it kind of forms an hourglass right in this area. That tells me that there's compression when it's coming across this area as well, telling me that that bicep tendon's not happy. And, you know, the nice part is there's an easy, this can be done under ultrasound in the office, that we don't want to put the injection so we can see the needle coming across. Here's the bicep tendon, and this is actually after it's been injected. But we're not injecting right into the tendon, but we're detecting into the sheath around it to put localized anti-inflammatories in this area to hopefully bring down the inflammation. On all these injections, what I do, first week, they're restricted from any overhead activity. They're basically just doing activities of daily living. The second week, let them slowly start getting back with range of motion type things. The reason being is I always tell my patients as far as steroid injection, it takes a full week for the steroid to kick in. So we always mix it with Marcaine, lidocaine. That's the thing that's gonna kick in 6 to 12 hours. That's gonna make them feel good, but the true effect of the steroid really takes about 7 days to kick in. So I always warn the patient after they're done, if you call me in 48 hours, I'm just gonna tell you to wait longer. So it kind of stops some of the calls. The next thing you have to do once you're pain-free is really get back on working the posterior capsule because I think that's a main contributor to. And we'll kind of look at that when we look at GERD as well, of causing the tendonitis as well as reestablishing the periscapular muscles as well. So like I said, they most resolve conservative measures. The ones that normally don't resolve normally have some comorbidity. So like I said, the girl that we injected got better, but then the symptoms reoccurred. That's what kind of led me to the idea, should we take her back with an arthroscope and actually take a look at it since we had two negative MRIs. So you have to look at if things don't initially get better and then they don't fit the picture, then you have to start looking elsewhere. Next thing, distal clavicle osteolysis. This is more, not so much the high school, but you look in the college levels when you start seeing it, it's normally like the 20 or 30 year olds. There are these big muscle bodybuilder type things you're gonna see, but it's basically repetitive stress over the area of the distal clavicle. And this is the kind of patient that normally comes into my office, honestly, that has this. If not, it's the 80-year-old that just has bad arthritis everywhere. But really in the 20 male weightlifters, risk factors actually are previous AC separations. I think does have a factor in that because I think you've already had some inherent injury to the joint as well as previous clavicle fractures. I don't think so much the mid-shaft clavicle fractures, but definitely the more distal clavicle fractures. history, more of the overhead activity, more of the, just really, I think about this more of the bench press activity and the more the bodybuilder type things that are doing the huge amount of weight. But a lot of these patients can't sleep on that affected side at all. So that's when you start thinking the nighttime pain, do they have a rotator cuff tear? Most of them are pretty functional, except for when it comes to their physical exam, it's that crossbody adduction, and they are really just point tender right on their chromoclavicular joint. Imaging, radiographs, plain film radiographs help, I think, on the AP as well as the Zanka view. You can see, if it's more advanced, a lot of times you can see some cystic formation as well as a lot of times some osteophytes. But if it's not, if it's more in the acute setting, what you see more is what we see on this axial image here. You can see cysts here at the end of the distal clavicle as well as a ton of inflammation is on this T2 image. Everything should be dark on here and fluids and show up in white. So you can see this person has a ton of inflammation at the area of the chromoclavicular joint. A lot of times too, you can see, it doesn't show up well here, with trace bone marrow edema here at the area of the distal clavicle as well. So this thing, this as well, most of the time, non-operative management, activity modification, you wanna change the weightlifters. A lot of times change their grip, change how far they're bringing down the bar on bench press, as well as a lot of times, a thing that can be hugely effective is injections right into the chromoclavicular joint. This is one joint, it is a joint by nature because it's two bones coming together, but one that I'm okay injecting, you know, every 3 to 6 months. I have about 5 different police officers that all have this on their shooting arm. None of them want to do anything. They don't really want to do therapy, but every 3 to 6 months I get a phone call, can I go get another injection? I stop, in my fellowship, we used to do these injections in the office. It's the most miserable thing for yourself as well as the patient, because what you can see, there's different angles that the AC joint comes down. Maybe it come down here, here. If you don't get a great x-ray, you really don't know what that angle is. And what you do is you spend about 5 minutes bumping off the end of the clavicle until it falls in. They're not happy with you. So what I do now is I send them to the IR guy. So if they miss, they're not happy with them and they're okay with me. Other thing is you look at the AC joint here, and this really doesn't come out well, but this is the end of the clavicle here. Here's the acromion. So a much easier way, and what this is doing is it's actually holding the ultrasound machine right in front, A to P, and what you can do is actually bring the needle straight down in a superior to inferior position and get right in that area under ultrasound guided, and you don't have to spend that whole time popping around with the needle. Again, anti-inflammatory is another good mainstay. Very few of these, I make these patients fail at least 6 months to a year of non-operative management before we talk about doing anything surgically. Patients get some relief, but with these bodybuilders, when you tell them they can't do any heavy lifting for 3 months, that kind of they're okay with the injection because you have to give it some time to do this. There's two mainstays of doing this, arthroscopic or open, and if you go to a shoulder society meeting, they'll spend hours debating which one's better. So I don't think there's a mainstay which is better. I prefer to do open just because I can see, and I've seen a lot of second opinions, which I don't think I uploaded this, but there's one where the guy headed in the wrong direction and took off the entire acromion. And so that's a fun x-ray to look at as a second opinion when they don't have an acromion, but their distal clavicle arthritis is still there because the distal clavicle is still there. So the only advantage is arthroscopic is you get a view of the glenohumeral joint, but I just maintain scoping all the shoulders before I do this anyway to look for any additional pathology. I'm a little short on time, so I'm gonna kind of fly through the glenohumeral internal rotation deficit. This is another big one that I see a lot, but it's really, if you look at the textbook, 20 to 30 degrees kind of varies about internal rotation deficit compared to the contralateral side, mainly in overhead athletes. I think this is one, even if he's kind of coming through his follow-up through, you see he's not getting a whole lot of external rotation with the ball on his wind-up. Pathology, and this is where we kind of go back to the humerus as well. So what we have is we have the posterior capsule here, but as we start getting tightness, what we're doing as they're coming up in an abduction external rotated position is we're actually offsetting the humeral head to a more anterior superior position up here. And you think about if the bicep tendon's running normally this course and attaching up here, this is why we're getting some bicep pathology as well, because what we're doing is we're probably abutting it against the coracoid more than anything. So a lot of times these can overlap, But it's one of those things, well, why is he having bicep tendonitis? He's probably having it because he has all this posterior capsule tightness because we're doing this. So we can eject the bicep all we want. If we don't bring this back over here, we're going to have this continued problem. These symptoms can be vague, sometimes painless. A lot of times it's more brought in because they're having elbow pain, or the coach notices they're not throwing right, or their velocity or control's changed. And most of the time when I see these in throwers are more that they're having elbow pain. And the first thing I look at elbow pain is I have them lay down and I check the internal rotation on both sides at the same time. And this, even though they, so I think that's the best, the best way to really look at this. I think a duplicate slide here, but sitting, this is the best picture I did, so I didn't violate HIPAA and take any pictures of my patients, but really laying down. And the best thing you can do with mom and dad sitting there is have them lay so they're facing the patient. And when they really see that, I think that hits home and really gets the point across to the parents as well. Reason, it talks about increased sulcus sign, and the whole reason you're getting a sulcus sign is not really instability, it's that we're pushing the humeral head anteriorly. So when we're doing that, we're actually getting a pseudo sulcus sign more than anything. And we see it with most athletes, they're compensating at that point. So we're seeing a decrease in internal rotation and an increase in external rotation. Radiographs, we always get these, especially if they come in for an elbow. We're checking that, especially in an adolescent with open physis, to make sure they don't have an avulsion fracture. But a lot of times the shoulder, all this is gonna be negative. On a routine basis, I do not get MRIs on this. We start with non-operative first because unless there's something glaring, I don't see a point in an MRI. It's really not going to change my treatment management. So again, the mainstay of this is non-operative management. It's really the sleeper stretch and really stretching out that posterior capsule. Everyone says, well, how long does that take? Well, I don't know. I normally tell you as long as it's been going on, as long as I need to kind of get that stretched out, because that takes a while to go. But at that same time, they're shut down from all throwing activity as well. So you can see it kind of got blocked out, but 90% of throwers, if you look at the literature, respond to PT and physical therapy. The 10% are really older people, and that's more, I think, a frozen shoulder outlook than it is this tightness of the posterior capsule. Most anyone in the 50s, 60s is not going to just be an isolated posterior capsule tightness. It's going to be more of a global adhesive capsulitis. And then our last one we're going to get to is little leaguer shoulder. And this is one that's just really an overuse injury. This is not an acute injury, but it's a Soltarius II physeal injury. And it's really just, and only seen in CLC immature. And I think most of the time in patients with closed physis, you're gonna see more of the rotator cuff pathology than you are. And I think the reason you're seeing this in younger kids is they're actually failing through the growth plate, because that's really the weakest point between the myotendinous junctions here. So quoted in the literature, 10% of all pediatric shoulder pains, you're really gonna see this. I mean, this is the typical kid that's gonna come in with a little leaguer shoulder. So it's a repetitive stress. Like I said, this is not an acute issue. And you look at this, maximally external rotative position, you're putting 400% greater strength than what the physis can tolerate when you start in late caulking. So you have these pitchers, and we're gonna get to this pitch count. There's a reason why we have pitch counts. There's a reason why we have breaks, because these shoulders aren't meant for the stresses of pitching. And you go to some of these little league games and these kids are pitching insane number of pitches, as well as quicker than they ever pitched when I played. I mean, I don't think my nephew tried to pitch to me last weekend. I couldn't hit a single ball because it was coming faster than I thought. But we also, you see breaking pitches. The other thing he wanted to show me was he was proud his coach taught him how to throw a changeup at 11. So now coach and I are going to have a talk this weekend at his tournaments and say we're not going to learn how to throw changeups at 11. But really, this is more for my resident talk than anything, but this is a highly tested topic. It always fails through the hypertrophic zone, and that's with most injuries of physeal injuries in adolescents. Presentation, most of the time they're not bringing them in until there's a decreased pitch velocity as well as decreased pitch accuracy, but a lot of times they come in with elbow pathology as well. Most throwers in adolescents will get bilateral x-rays of the shoulders as well as the elbows, just as comparison views as well. A lot of times they have tenderness right over that physis area, and the pain is reproducible if you really put them through the throwing motion. Radiographs, I mean, these are pretty easy to see most of the time on radiographs. You can see the separation of the physis on A compared to B on the contralateral side. There's a definite separation in this area. Sometimes they're negative, and if it's really looking like that in a thrower's shoulder, then I will get an MRI in this because I think this really does help with management. But what you can see here is the physis, and we should not see any edema in the bone coming across the physis on this coronal view. And that's really what tells, you know, hopefully, you know, we get MRIs to make sure we rule out any other pathology. I've yet to see any rotator cuff pathology or anything like that. I'll probably knock on wood because I'll probably see that on Friday at my next clinic. But hopefully it's not something you want to see on a routine basis. Best thing that you do, and this is where you become the really bad guy, is you stop throwing. And this is where you fight. And you get the tears that look like this, but then you get the parents that look like this. And you get the parents that come into my office, then they are in full baseball gear at 10 o'clock on a Tuesday morning, wearing their cleats. And they think that if we shut them down for any period of time, this is going to cross their major league career. So that's a lot of times where you spend most of your time spending. But really, refrain from pitching for 3 months because this truly is a fracture. And if you don't treat this, we're going to have change in the metaphyseal area, as well as if they keep loading it, they can actually get changes in the glenoid as well. So you get more of a retroverted glenoid if they continue to pitch through this. So again, mainstay, we stop them. But what I do, a lot of times, these kids will also have an internal rotation deficit. So we get started, first month they don't do anything, second month they get started with physical therapy, and then we kind of progress into a throwing program. And never do I do this as a progression of throwing program that we give to the parents that they start. They do this under supervision of a physical therapist so we can check their throwing technique and make sure they're following that correctly. So prevention, we can spend days debating the pitch count. There's different ones, but you know, the pitch count, discouraging breaking balls is really the mainstay of preventing this, as well as some of the internal rotation deficits as well, and little leaguer's elbow as well. So I'm going to kind of speed through this. My approach, like I said, most of my patients that come in, at that point when they come in, they're acutely inflamed shoulders. So we got to do something so we can get a good exam. So my mainstay, if a patient comes in, they have shoulder pain, maybe they have a little neck pain, it hurts up into the trap. My mainstay is a subacromial injection. Now, will I do that in an athlete? Depends on the time, depends on the season, depends on their age. If they have open growth plates, they're not getting a subacromial injection. If we're in the off season, baseball pitcher, probably get a subacromial injection. If we're in the middle of the season, we're probably going more with anti-inflammatories or a steroid pack. After that, once we can get everything calmed down, I think that's the best time when you can get a physical exam. If you just do the shotgun approach and they're hugely inflamed in their shoulder, you get an MRI and you get a bunch of inflammation everywhere, I don't really think that gives you a great idea of what you're, where you're going after that. So, like I said, physical exam, helpful and kind of giving you an area where you need to go. Sometimes cuff tears can lag behind. Sometimes people can compensate for huge cuff tears. You just have an open eye. And I think this is in your handout. I won't spend any time on this. This is a slide of bar from my partner, Steve Flores. Kind of gives you a roundabout when you're looking at age, what the likelihoods of them having each one of these different diagnoses, and kind of leads you in that direction. So, inclusion, symptoms and physical exam can overlap. Not every athlete needs an MRI. Like I said, I spend more time talking them out of an MRI than trying to convince them unless I show them the cost for it. Biggest thing, neck pathology can give you shoulder pain, shoulder pathology can give you neck pain. And that's one thing why I really like the subacromial injection or anti-inflammatories, so it gives me a guide on which direction I need to go. So, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Camarillo. Anybody have any